Peter Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about clarification of some of the finer points of quantum mechanics. Now, you're going to hear a little bit of background noise as it's just quietly raining in the balcony of this veranda that I'm sitting at in a lounge chair, hopefully not beaten by mosquitoes because the rain will knock out most of the mosquitoes coming around the place. I'm going to give a few insights into, I suppose, traps you can fall into doing your own study of quantum mechanics. In generally, are very good textbooks. They don't have these problems. But if you decide to actually pull up quantum mechanics by specialist notes, you can often find these mistakes. You read along and you say, oh, that's a mistake, or that's incorrect. So there's some sort of really basic things, I suppose, gone wrong. So let's go over. And what I want to do is cover spin, which is really the sort of most quantum mechanical of quantum mechanical properties. Now, first we're going to start off. So I'm just going to go in, describe what happens, and then say what the actual you tend to read in the literature. The general things you do, you click on, and eventually you get put to this person from the subcontinent in a nice iron shirt in front of a blackboard, stating stuff and more or less reading out their notes and writing them up. And some of the mistakes get from internet notes to them, they circulate the way through. So we're going to start off with in the age before spin, in quantum mechanics, with a pack of people, Germans in 1922, Stern and Gellert, one was going to turn out to be an ultra-Nazi, the other one was going to be, they're going to go on and fight on different sides of the war eventually. But when they were buddies, one had stumbled across the idea of molecular beam, and I must admit, because I worked on a molecular beam in my honours year, I sort of absolutely love it. So his idea, the first thing I want to say is that often in the early textbooks they will say a stream of electrons, and indeed this is not the case. It was actually a little oven where you heated up some silver. The silver evaporated and went through these slots. So they had a vacuum path, and the silver atoms would go and silver up a slide. What would happen is that you'd have these two apertures. So the silver atoms, when they heated up, would form this gas, and the gas would expand into vacuum. So they'd be bouncing around randomly in this oven. And then if they went to hit the wall of the oven, they'd go through the hole, not hit any other gas, and continue in a straight line. So it's a molecular beam, but it's more like a molecular leak into a vacuum chamber. And the vacuum chamber would be sucked down, so there'd be a large mean-free path, i.e. that all the particles were sucked out, such that the helium... silver would go through. So silver's got sort of a whole series of properties, it has one extra electron. I think it's got 43. It's got 44th electron is an unpaired electron. Now, in terms of spin, this is important. But back then, before they knew spin, they were trying to actually work out whether this entire story of an electron orbiting a nucleus, of a nucleus, was so preposterous. They were trying to get it as an experiment which would disprove prove war. So they're out to disprove it, which is great. This idea of science trying to disprove, trying to find counterexamples. There was an example of that trying to, I think, disprove Einstein's photoelectric effect. Millikan, who was a bit of a racist in New York, sorry, not New York, in California, a bit of a shady racist person, didn't like Einstein, and helped actually prove Einstein right. It's one of these things. So these sorts of people were trying to disprove Bohr through a calamity of mistakes. They actually produced silver atoms. Now, the silver atoms are neutral. That is, it's the way of putting an atom through, which has got a negative charge, so it's got the negative charge with the positive nucleus, it's a neutral one. And it's also ideal because it sticks, the atom goes through and it sticks to the plate, so you can integrate your experiment over a long time. So they didn't have a particle detector, they had a plate, and so the story goes. They were lucky to have a poor quality acidic cigar, and the cigar smoke darkened the silver so they could see the outcome. The outcome was this, these silver atoms were effectively carrying a unpaired electron. Now, back at this stage, spin was proposed a year later. So they didn't have an explanation of it, so they inadvertently proved spin, discovered spin before they knew what they had discovered. And they thought they'd discovered something else. They thought they'd discovered an orbital angular momentum that was completely immune. So the idea is angular momentum is it goes, it's like a surface of you angular momentum is like a weight, a flywheel, and if that flywheel is charged, that charge is a current, and therefore you're making a little solenoid, and so you've got a little magnet. Now, the suppose the important thing is that magnets in a magnetic field do not move. That is, a magnet has got they will twist, but once they've aligned, they no longer move. And so it's an inhomogeneous, a great magnetic field gradient which it goes through. Stern-Gerlach understood this. But the subsequent people producing the notes just say it goes through a magnetic field. So if you're like myself and you just go through and self-educate, you're just going to miss this because you read all these notes and very rarely do they say a magnetic field gradient. So they created this sort of like a point in a circle to create this magnetic field gradient. And it's in a magnetic field gradient that you actually feel magnetic force. So this is an important point, that it's the things that I've been told incorrect early on is that it was electrons, but more often now that I've read it, it's I hope you can still hear me through all this noise. It's actually a magnetic field gradient, and this is often when you read off the internet, it's there. I hope you can still hear me through all of this. I'm going to speak a little bit louder, but you know, it's welcome rain out here in Australia. Essentially 5 years of drought, it's now the dams are full. We're down to 40% for our major. So can you imagine Sydney is our New York, and you can imagine New York down to desperate desalination eras. And sort of when you get down to the bottom part of dams, you get sort of a pretty iffy drinking water coming through here. And of course, the intermittent rain means that when the rain does come through in drought conditions, it basically removes all the pollutants and puts it in your drinking water. So we're in pretty dire straits. But getting back into it. So the major thing is here that if you were trying to study quantum mechanics yourself, school textbooks, it's generally university textbooks which get it right, but even so it's rather poor, and university lectures, the good, I'd say 70% of them really don't know what they're talking about and goes through. Oh, he's pretty loud, so I hope you can hear me through this. I don't know. What we're going to do is then talk about the statement that the angular momentum increases in length. The angular momentum is quantized. And one would think for, say, spin, say, particularly, or other things, that the length of the angular momentum is h bar on 2. Now, specifically, what goes on is that's not correct. It's the actual projection onto the z-axis of the angular momentum is quantized. That means that for an angular momentum projection, zh of spin h-bar on 2, that's your effective measured angular momentum. The actual angular momentum vector is bigger by the square root of s into s plus 1. So the actual length of the angular momentum vectors can be into a half into a half plus 1, the square root of. So it's rather than if it was simply s by s squared, it would be by half, it would increase a half each time. The actual length of the angular momentum vector is a half into a half plus 1 all square. So that's the square root of 3 on 2, which is 1.7 times more. It's, I suppose it's a half. So it would be a half. Yeah, it's the length of the actual vector is 1.7. Is that right? Square root of 3 on 4. Square root of 3 on 2. Yeah. It's your actual vectors are slightly longer and they don't increase in quantized steps. The actual projection onto the z-axis is quantized. And so the actual angular momentum vector is greater than h bar on 2. It's h bar on 2, but it projects such that it has h bar on 2 on the x-axis. On the z-axis. So it's actually inclined to the z-axis by a bit over 64 degrees, if you put it in. If you say, look, it's a half hs, half h on 2 upwards, and then it's actually cross the square root of h of h bar on or s plus half h bar on 2 into h into the square root of a half plus 3 on 2, which half, so it's the square root of 3 on 4, the square root of 3 on 2. That's the length there. So that actually inclines. So we do have, even though it's not mentioned anywhere in the books or anywhere on the explicitly in the notes, and sometimes it's actually wrong. You listen to people and they're all very serious. Now listen to this and they repeat, they make mistakes and they repeat the mistake to make sure, so they made the mistake once in lecture, and then they summarise and make it incorrect. So the z-axis projection of spin is h bar on 2. The actual spin is slightly longer than that, and it has to be inclined at an angle such that it has that projection. And then it's at a sufficient distance that it's at a sufficient length that it will have another projection onto minus h bar on 2. Its actual length, if I can say it again, is h bar the square root of 3 on 2 is the actual length of it. So it has that projection of a half across that. When it's actually over inclined, over 45 degrees to fit that. And so therefore it all makes sense because you've got a fixed angle that all electrons are to the z-axis. And the z-axis is defined by the magnetic field. So you get this bizarre thing, is that the magnetic field is sort of like a memory. No matter how weak it is, it can be accounted to be a memory of how the electron is made. At the beginning of time, the electron is made, or pretty much a short while after, the electron condenses out, and it will stick to a magnetic field line in which it's made, and always remain with that to the rest of eternity to go across. Now, it therefore means that your vector addition produces your J's and your S's coming across onto it. Isn't that absolutely pouring with bloody rain, isn't it? So you've always got to do that S into S plus 1. Now, I wonder what the statistics is for that. But that's an important point. So coming back on it, and I don't think I'm going to bother reading with this rain of this next, the way of Zhang-Zhou. So these are two major stumbling blocks if you didn't have it. One is that magnets get attracted by a non-uniform field gradient. The other thing is that the length of your spin and angular momentum vectors do not increase in a quantized manner. They increase in length. If they were to increase in length, they increase by S into the square root of S into S plus 1. Not by S, but by this other, they go slightly more than integral length. They go slightly longer, such that they can have that projection onto the z-axis. And this all goes to show that it's all ultimately to do with measurements and projection into our realm to go with that. So I see how this has gone. I'm sorry for this if there's too much beautiful, beautiful rain. It's beautiful here in Australia at the moment. Another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.